Greetings and welcome to the Navigator newsletter for the month May 2016. Or if you follow the Kemetic calendar, the year is 6250. This podcast is narrated and produced by Paul Ifeomi Grant.
Greetings. This is Ifeomi Grant, and welcome to the May issue of the Navigator newsletter. In this issue, there's two issues we're going to cover. Number one is an update on blackfinancialfitness.com, and number two, we're going to cover Brexit, the EU referendum in the UK, and why Britain should vote to leave the European Union, and why it probably won't matter, even if it does. Okay, so issue number one, update on blackfinancialfitness.com. Well, this is very brief. Just to tell you, I'm still looking for your feedback. We've had some hiccups completing the website. However, the work's continuing. If you go to the site, you'll see that we're adding more content. If you go to the Success Series course, which is free, you'll see there's a couple of interviews uploaded there. That's a free place where I add in interviews from people who I think have been successful and whose stories will be useful for yourself. There's still the SurveyMonkey survey, so if you get the when you get the written edition of the newsletter, there'll be a link to the SurveyMonkey survey, which is just to get some feedback on how the site's looking, how easy it is to navigate, that sort of thing. Thanks to those people who've completed the survey already. I will be recording a short video introduction to put up on the site, so that's in response to one bit of feedback I had. I'm also going to be putting up some information about the affiliate program, which people wanted some more clarity on. So I'll have that information when the site's pretty much ready to go. So that'll be probably the last thing I'll put up. And I'm also looking to create a frequently asked questions section. So what I'd really like is if you could provide me with any questions you've got about the site, how it works, or what it's trying to achieve. If you include those questions in the very last question of the survey, go to the SurveyMonkey survey, and then there's a comment section, the very last question. If you can put in there any questions you'd like to see in the answered in the FAQ section, that would be really useful. So go to blackfinancialfitness.com. My statistic for the day is that 62% of Americans have less than $1,000 in savings, which I think is quite shocking. I mean, that's $1,000, that's what, less than £700 in savings. So that's just one reason why we need blackfinancialfitness.com. Okay, so let's get on to the main issue, the meaty issue for this newsletter, which is about Brexit, which is the shorthand term for should Britain exit the European Union. And I'm just going to give you my views on the EU and the EU referendum. So on 23rd of June this year, that's when the EU referendum takes place. And many of the UK population are going to go to the polls and decide whether it should be in or out. Now, the context for this is that the UK Prime Minister, David Cameron, he offered a referendum before the last general election in the UK. And he did this to reduce the political threat posed by UKIP. Now, UKIP is the UK Independence Party, which is virulently anti-European Union, anti-immigrant, anti many things. Now, he was happy to offer the referendum because he didn't actually expect to win an outright majority in the last British general election. All the sort of polls and all the political pundits were firmly predicting that no party would have an overall majority and it would be another sort of hung parliament. They'd need to have a coalition like they did the last time with the Liberal Democrats. So he knows that the Liberal Democrats are strongly pro-European, EU. So he fully expected that they would block any attempt by him to have an EU referendum because the Liberal Democrats know that Britain is quite Eurosceptic, quite split in terms of the population. So as things worked out, he was happy to get a majority, but now he's landed himself with this conundrum of the EU referendum that he had to stick to. Now, in terms of the main political parties, all the three main political parties in terms of their leaderships, the Conservatives, Labour and Liberal Democrats, they're all supporting the yes or stay in the EU vote. However, there's quite strongly varying degrees of dissension within each of the parties, ranging from very strong dissension within the Conservative Party. So there's a number of cabinet ministers who are campaigning for a no vote out of the EU vote. There's mild dissension within the Labour Party, and right along the spectrum to minuscule dissension among the Liberal Democrats. You're hard pushed to find a Liberal Democrat who's in favour of leaving the EU. Now, most of the corporate media, including the BBC, are behind a yes vote, although they don't say that. Well, the BBC doesn't say that publicly because they're supposed to be impartial. And so the debate is framed in terms of the corporate media, in terms of, on the one hand, open-minded, forward-thinking progressives versus Little Englander, narrow-minded xenophobes and racists on the other. So the xenophobes and racists and Little Englanders are the people who want to leave the EU. Now, the fact that the most Eurosceptic political party in the UK, which I mentioned before, the United Kingdom Independence Party, UKIP, is actually full of Little Englander, narrow-minded xenophobes and racists only confirms this simplistic narrative. However, the reality is that there are plenty of people, albeit a minority from the left, the so-called left of the political spectrum, who are against or sceptical of the EU, and they actually include the Labour Party's leader, Jeremy Corbyn, who in the past has spoken out against the EU, but he's had to perform a political volte-face in order to keep his party united. And there's also many on the so-called right of his party. So Labour Party is supposed to be the left-wing party, not very left-wing, but supposed to be a left-wing party. But there's many on what they call the Blairite wing, the people who kind of supported the sort of war criminal tendency type Labour Party of Tony Blair. And they've been furiously against Jeremy Corbyn as soon as it became obvious he was going to become leader of the Labour Party. And they want to oust him as soon as possible. So he's trying to hold together his party. So in a way, he's having to disavow his previous Eurosceptic views. And then overall, you have people in the Conservative Party who are firmly pro-European, people like Kenneth Clark, former cabinet minister and what they call a Conservative grandee. So the picture is not clear. It's not simply on the right of the spectrum, you're against the EU, and left of the spectrum, you're pro the EU. Most are, but there's dissension on both sides. So all of that to say that with so many political questions, you have to step back and ask yourself fundamental questions before deciding on which side of the debate you stand. This is particularly aimed, obviously, at people in the UK. But I think if you're from elsewhere, you need to think about how this debate is framed. And it ties in with the whole Obama mania stuff that I wrote about before he's elected, during his first term, during his second, how Africans were seduced by simplistic, symbolic language and imagery and didn't actually probe the substance of issues or politicians. So the first thing you have to be clear about is that you should not be worried about being on the same side of a debate as people with whom you generally disagree on most political issues. So don't look at necessarily just who's on which side of the debate, because it's actually perfectly possible and it's actually quite common for people to agree on an issue for very different reasons. So the reality is that there are unpleasant people on both sides of the EU debate in Britain. So this should be inconsequential in a person's deliberations. You need to look at the issues themselves and what's at stake, and what's at stake for you and your community, rather than thinking about who's on which side of the debate, because they may have very different reasons for having the same or different views to you. Now, in the title to this newsletter, I've obviously nailed my colours to the mast. So before I tell you why I'll be voting for Britain to leave the EU, and I very rarely ever vote, I think I voted once in my life back in the 80s, I'll suggest some basic questions you need to be asking yourself when weighing up the pros and cons of this issue. So, EU questions in search of honest answers. Some of the questions you need to ask yourself. One, why was the EU, or as it was back in the day, the European Economic Community, why was it created? Number two, what are the main arguments used by either side of the debate and do they stand up to scrutiny? Number three, what is the level of accountability of the people who direct and lead the EU? Number four, what is the level of transparency in EU decision making? Number five, is there any relationship between continental / regional institutions such as the EU, the AU, which is the African Union, NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, etc.? And if so, what does this tell you? Number six, on which side of the debate do most of the corporate powers and plutocrats sit? Number seven, what's in it for you? Number eight, what's in it for your community / nation? So those are the kind of questions that people should be asking themselves. Now, I'm not going to cover all of these questions and arguments because it'd be another mega long edition if I did, but I'm sure you're intelligent enough to find out some of this information yourself to supplement what I'm going to tell you. And of course, you don't need to believe anything I say. You can always do your own research. Now, in terms of the media, I would say that the dice is firmly loaded. The publicly funded, the publicly funded British Civil Service, which is supposed to be impartial in politics, they're not allowed to assist ministers who support Britain exiting the EU, but they can assist government ministers who support the government line. So if your government minister supports Britain staying in, you can get assistance from the civil service, but not if you're against Britain leaving the EU. And also the media, the publicly funded media, which is funded by every household with a television, is clearly in favour of a yes vote. Their quote-unquote journalists cannot come out and explicitly say so. However, the nature of the coverage, if you watch it carefully, it makes it very clear where the BBC loyalty lies. And given that it is a states-funded broadcaster and all of the main political parties in terms of their leadership support the yes vote, this is hardly surprising. And if you think back, just as with all the rapacious wars conducted by the United States, with the support from the United Kingdom government in particular, we see that the repeating of government propaganda as unquestioned facts means that the public is ill-served by the BBC, which is an outdated institution. From my point of view, the BBC should have its license fee scrapped, and if it wants to exist, it should do so on the basis of advertising or subscription. You only have to go back to the BBC's coverage of the Iraq War and issues such as Saddam Hussein's fictional weapons of mass destruction and the idea that Iraq could strike Britain militarily in 45 minutes to realise that the BBC is little more than a sophisticated version of the ex-Soviet Union's Pravda news agency. So let's look at some of the leaders of the Yes Vote campaign. So we've got the current Prime Minister, David Cameron, who's a war criminal. We've got the ex-Prime Minister, Tony Blair, who's a war criminal. We've got virtually all of the chief executives of transnational corporations operating in the UK supporting the yes vote. And even President Barack Obama, another war criminal and corporate servant, he's even intervened in what is essentially a UK domestic matter to offer only slightly coded warnings of the dire consequences of the UK leaving the EU. And as I mentioned, Jeremy Corbyn, he's a hostage of the Labour Party. Most of the Labour Party support Britain staying in the European Union. And in this case, it's actually the leader who has to toe the party line. So, just carrying on in a slight diversion, but I think it's important in terms of understanding the reality and limitations of so-called democracy. If you go back to September last year, September 2015, in the aftermath of Jeremy Corbyn's election as Labour Party leader, there are some comments that were really instructive. We were told in the Independent newspaper back then that a senior serving general, this is a general in the army, has reportedly warned that a Jeremy Corbyn government could face a quote-unquote mutiny from the army if it tried to downgrade them. This was in the wake of him making comments that he might reduce the size of Britain's army. The unnamed general said members of the armed forces would begin directly and publicly challenging the Labour leader if he tried to scrap Trident, which is Britain's nuclear submarine system, pull out of NATO or announce quote-unquote, any plans to emasculate and shrink the size of the armed forces. You notice the use of the term emasculate. The general, he told the Sunday Times, in quotes, the army just wouldn't stand for it. The general staff would not allow the prime minister to jeopardise the security of this country, and I think people would use whatever means possible, fair or foul, to prevent that. You can't put a maverick in charge of a country's security. There would be mass resignations at all levels, and you'd face the very real prospect of an event which would effectively be a mutiny. That was in the Sunday, that was in the Independent on Sunday, the 20th of September 2015. So, in effect, as you've heard, this general was advocating and threatening what, in effect, is treason, because mutiny is treason when you're talking about the highest levels of the army. And that's still one of the few crimes that carries the death penalty in the UK. However, there was remarkably little fuss about this general's comments, either from the BBC or the corporate TV and print media. But these comments were shot across the bow for Corbyn, delivered through the Sunday Times newspaper, which has for many decades had close ties with the UK security forces. They're long known as a conduit for putting stories out from the security forces. So that kind of shows you that there's an establishment consensus in the UK, as well as in many other countries, which is maintained and supported by civil servants, the media, and the armed forces, irrespective of which political party is in power. And any politician who seriously challenges this agenda is in for a very rough ride. So to be clear, the UK establishment is firmly behind Britain remaining in the EU. And we've seen the media coalescing and come together to repeatedly try to undermine the campaigns of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, who are very different in their political views, but are to some extent outsiders who the establishment are not completely sure they could control. Okay, so let's look at the European Union and ask ourselves, why was it the European Union created? So in my view, the EU is part of an incremental march towards a globalised political order, encompassing trade deals such as TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and it also encompasses global financial institutions such as the IMF, World Bank, Bank of International Settlements, institutions created at the end or just after the Second European World War. Encompasses ideas like the cashless society, which will entrench the power of the financial institutions, a globalised military led under European leadership, and of course NATO already in effect performs this role, and of course things like normalising global surveillance, all your internet, email, communication, phone communication, virtually every form of public communication. And this is the New World Order that George Herbert Walker Bush was talking about. That's the first Bush president back in the early 1990s. So you need to be clear what I'm saying. I'm not saying there's going to be a world government. I know many people talk about this world government that's coming, because there's actually no need for a world government located in Washington or anywhere else in order to control world politics. The aim of the plutocrats, who the politicians serve, is to control events globally, not necessarily to have a singular global government, because control works better if it's hidden rather than if it's overt. If there was an attempt to create a world government, people would be extremely concerned. You may see serious revolt against such an idea. But if you keep notionally national governments, but they come under institutional control, then you can in effect have the workings of a global government without actually having an explicit global government. So for example, anyone with any sense realizes that NATO is the arrowhead and cover for US imperialism. And you should note, for those people who are thinking there's any substantive difference between many of the people on the yes or no votes in the European Union, the leading Eurosceptic, Boris Johnson, who's formerly Mayor of London, he says that NATO provides the UK's guarantee of peace, which is laughable. NATO is simply a cover to allow the US to do its dirty work under cover of a coalition. Now, for propaganda purposes, it's really important for the US's foreign interventions not to be viewed as unilateral in nature. So to supplement NATO, the US also creates its coalitions of the willing to support military action and outright wars in far-flung places. So they say we've got 40 countries all together, you know, coalition of the willing, overturning some horrible regime. And we also know that the US is often referred to as the world's policeman. It has NATO as its cover institution, and it pulls other nations into the military fold as and when needed. So there's no need for a world army when you can invade nations around the world and overthrow their governments without one, which is what the US wants the ability to do. It wants to be the and remain the global hegemon. The same can be said of institutions such as the IMF and World Bank, which are notionally global, but again, most people who've done any reading know that they're widely recognized as instruments of US governmental and corporate interests. Under the envisaged globalized structure, what you'll have is regional federal superstates such as the EU, which will be mirrored in other parts of the world, including Africa via the African Union. NAFTA is a proposed mechanism for North America, and the other continental regions will follow suit. There will still be national governments. However, they will have ceded significant power to the regional centre, as we see with the EU, particularly in terms of the Eurozone of the EU. Now, in terms of how these ideas started off, they started off with a seemingly compelling logic. And so the EEC, which was the European Economic Community, as the EU originally was originally sold as a forum for political and economic cooperation on continental Europe to prevent any possibility of a repeat of the horrors of the two European world wars. Now, the idea of increasing cooperation amongst formerly warring states seemed and does seem eminently sensible. The EEC was to be an economic community, as it was felt that nations that had close economic ties were less likely to want to engage in hostilities. It was meant to be about jobs, not political union, or at least that was the line that was sold. However, from the very outset, the people who crafted and shaped the formation of the EEC had a grander vision with a federal political union as the ultimate goal. And I've in the written version, I put a bit of a timeline link for you. The BBC's got a timeline in the EU, and in the second part, we'll talk about what that timeline tells you about the people who created the EEC.